we would really welcome questions and comments. Could we have a light on the audience, too? And the chap who is wandering around with a camera regrets very much not being able to see the audience because he wanted to take some pictures. Is he here? No. Well, we can do that later in the weekend. Befriending the guards struck a nerve with me. I would say that in my own experience, at least half the time that I've managed to achieve a realization of a work, I owe that to the guards. Informed expectations is a barrier. Negotiating the museum and permission to reorganize existing specimens. Interweaving text, as Terry does, with images. And Robert's astute awareness of embedded governing narratives. There are all kinds of things that we could talk about, and I invite your comments and questions. Yeah. Can we dim this light a bit so that I could see?
I have a question for Robert, please.
Robert.
I was wondering, you said that you resigned.
Could we have a microphone over here, please?
Okay. I have a question for Robert. You said you resigned after all those discriminating practices you felt the museums were carrying out in context with the indigenous art practices, if I may call it that. Don't you think that that is not a very good step, because in longer run, unless and until the artists with Indian background are more involved in these institutions, the changes cannot be brought about?
It's a long question, right? What are you asking me? Are you asking me I may have done the wrong thing by leaving because I should have stayed and fought the war?
Yes.
Oh, well, you know what? I think my leaving, I've thought about this over and over again. Let me be a little bit more personal. When I left the museum and I came to Toronto immediately after, I stayed in Ottawa, because we're talking about Ottawa at this time, and I did get some contract work as an independent curator, but I was also had been exhibiting here in Toronto as a visual artist. I already had a couple shows at the Pollock Gallery at that time. But because my resignation appeared in every major paper from Vancouver to Halifax, Carol Gore, who is now major editor in the column in the Toronto Star, you know, we had a picture of me standing in a collection room with holding a mask and with a bucket at my feet, because at that time the museum had not been built and we were somewhere in Bell's Corners and the roofs were leaking. So that became a very potent image as well. But you know, I came to Toronto and I would lie down because I didn't have a job, right? And I'm looking at the ceiling and I'm saying, oh, what have I done? You know, I left a very good job and here's this, at that time it was Indian, you know, this Indian guy, you know, how the audacity for him to resign. He's being, you know, he had this job and, you know, but in retrospect, I would not have lasted if I would have stayed. And I certainly have had a much more unobstructed voice since leaving. I was able to develop. Of course, for a while, I was a person non grata because of that. Nobody would exhibit me. And nobody took contemporary First Nations art at that time seriously at all. If they had to exhibit it, they had to hold their noses. not much has really changed. There are a few optics, but you know, no, I don't regret it, and I think in many ways I've done more service, not only to myself, to my work, to my practice, but also to other my compatriots, other Native artists. I think if I would have stayed, like I said in my last statement, I would have spiritually and artistically perished.
Thank you.
Could I ask the questioner to identify herself, please?
Asma Arshad, artist.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, did I answer you? Okay. Okay. So.
Yes. Microphone, please.
Thank you very much. Griselda Pollock asking a question. I wanted just to put to the whole panel or something to pick up between Terry Atkinson's questions at the beginning and the point that David ended with, which was in some ways this old or still very considered idea that the artwork speaks for itself, which is, to go back to Joanne Lamoureux's notion, to attribute to the artwork some kind of subject position from which it's speaking to you, as opposed to, in a sense, a subject-subject relationship mediated by some kind of practice, which is, seemed to me, a different proposition that Terry was putting to us, that the experience in the exhibition space is not to encounter an object or a work that in some fetishistic way has a human attribution in itself, but to encounter, work with, or engage with some kind of continuing process of practice. And I just wondered if, since the museal concept is still so strong, that once the artwork leaves the site of production, the studio, it ceases to be a practice, it becomes an object which is curated or collected or encountered or fantasized about, as opposed to, it seemed in the way that Terry Atkinson was presenting his sort of practice or his critical interrogation of what a practice is and what a subject is also then what is the subject of the practice of encountering somebody interrogating the question of a practice and a subject, which seems to me critically put what in fact Terry is asking of us, which challenges the separation of studio production, exhibition, distribution. So I wondered if anybody wanted to pick up on that. Thank you.
Now, in all modesty, I'm going to ask Terry to first translate your question and then answer it.
Well,
into the mic, please.
First anecdote is a response to David when we were talking about, or when he was talking about guards, with the very word. I was once in the National Gallery in London talking to someone, and the guard came over and told me, I couldn't work out whether he was telling me to speak more quietly or not to speak at all. And then when I turned to him, he said, don't speak to me. So there is a sense in which, you know, the whole authoritarian structure of the gallery is to do with what I think David Bainbridge was hinting about in some notion of experience, and that this experience is kind of mute. You don't speak. Griselda's question, that's a Leeds question.
I grew up in Leeds.
Yeah, and it raises a lot of interesting problems for me, I think. I mean, curating, I don't know whether I said this, because I was speaking so fast, I couldn't remember what I'd said.
He did that to reproach me,
yeah,
you understand that?
Yeah. And I haven't finished.
He hasn't finished.
But I always see curating as somehow to do with a career more than a practice. I think you make a practice and you curate a career. And Joseph Kosuth's done some interesting interventions, one of the best of which I think was a thing called The Play of the Unmentionables at the Brooklyn Museum, when he curated not the entire collection, but significant parts of the collection in relation to the Reaganite punitive measures that were taken against Mapplethorpe, I think in Minneapolis. That struck me as an interesting intervention in that relation between curation and production. But having said that, the relation between curation and production may itself be a relation of production and curation. So I think the whole problem of how we sort out the work is turning somewhere in there. I think Judith had got hold of that, and my dispute with her about the way she wanted to curate my work was about that, I think. I mean, don't get me wrong when I said dispute. I mean, I think it was a very productive dispute. I'm not suggesting for a moment that we weren't interested in it. The other thing, I think, is this question of, you know, the role of the voice, how it's carried. I mean, one of the memories I have in the early 60s is as I was then in fine arts, but I was beginning to doubt what we were doing in fine arts as well. And one of the things that got me interested, so to speak, in leaving fine arts was the role of the voice that was emerging in American art magazines. I was much more interested, for example, in the voice of Don Jodd or Cal André than I was in the reproductions of the work that they had in the magazines, if the reproductions of the work in the magazines were to be treated in some kind of mute fashion. So I think in that sense, I could quite happily live without the work I've produced. I've got the slides, and I can do things like this. The advantage of having the work that you produced is it's marketable. In that, I mean, I might, with a really cute dealer, I might be able to sell what I'm doing now for much higher prices than I've got paid for coming here. But in a sense, that sounds glib, but I am more interested in this sort of encounter than I am in, so to speak, having my work in terms of the actual objects that were produced at Time X and Time Y curated. That's why I think teaching is at the center of the practice. I mean, it's not just teaching. For example, I prefer undergraduate students to graduate students. I prefer undergraduate students because it's a bit like the Vatican. They're younger. they're more malleable. They're more susceptible to the ideology I want to produce. And if they're more susceptible to the ideology I want to produce, they may be more susceptible to being able to counter the ideology I want to counter, and so on.
Now, Griselda, did that answer your question? Yes? No.
Who knows?
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
While we wait for you to formulate your questions and thoughts, I want to ask Spring Hill about a question. Whereas in the other three presentations, one had a sense of the dynamic negotiations going on between the artists in their various ways and the institution. With your presentation, I could only guess at it. Uh-huh. Can you say something about what went on backstage?
Is that working?
We need a mic over here. Sure, keep going.
I knew you would ask me this, Vera. What actually happened was that the Royal Ontario Museum was an institution that had invited me through the Institute of Contemporary Culture to do a conventional exhibition. In other words, they wanted me to do artwork in my studio and then bring it to the Roloff Benny Gallery in the Royal Ontario Museum, which is set up for contemporary exhibitions. And they wanted me to be inspired somehow by the ROM in some rather abstract way and come in with a finished body of work. And what I proposed, I counter-proposed to them that I would, in fact, be interested in doing something. And then I proposed that why not let me go and do real research in the museum, because the fact of bringing work into the Royal Ontario Museum seemed to be like a very tedious and redundant act, because I'd already shown that body of work or shown work like that in Toronto, in Canada, and it just didn't need to be repeated. It seemed to be like an isolated situation. So what I did was I made a counter-proposal. It was accepted. The curator, Elizabeth McLuhan, introduced me to the different department heads. She made an introduction of sorts, saying who I was and what I wanted to do. And then after that process, then it was up to me to negotiate with each department, and there were several departments that I was working with. I worked with, a majority of departments at the Royal Ontario Museum. And the structure of, I don't know if this is the case in all natural history and anthropology museums, but the structure was the way that type of museum is constructed is each department is very insular. Each department has its own set of policies, and they vary quite a bit from one department to department. So I had to work within a structure that from department to department varied a great deal. And this was where some people were extremely lucid and very inviting, and other department heads were extremely apprehensive and very concerned about their material and how would an artist actually put their material out into the public. There were issues too internally within some of the departments where material that I might be interested in, there was an attempt on some levels to create a censorship so that I wouldn't be able to use that material. There were a lot of ethical discussions that went on between myself and collections officers and curators in each department. So I had to defend my position in wanting to borrow what I was requesting. It was really highly demanding. I spent most of my time involved in negotiations, and maybe 25% of my time in actually having a lucid experience where I was involved in my own concept. Now, the situation at the Royal Ontario Museum is probably based on the fact that they don't have a lot of experience in dealing with contemporary art. That seemed to be the case. I did get involved with the people that I worked with. In other words, I took them at face value. I talked about what I wanted to achieve and what I wanted to do. I tried to build bridges. I tried really hard to create trust. And if they had issues, if they wanted to withhold artifacts or specimens, I really got into the whole debate with them. I got into the debate of ethics. I got into the debate of what it was. I tried to remain transparent, and I tried to address their issues. And if I couldn't address their issues of concern, what I did was I turned to my staff, and if it was a conservation issue, I tried to have that resolved so that they weren't fearful that the work would be damaged in any way. So basically, it was extremely challenging for me too. And on their side, I had no experience working in this type of museum, and I didn't know the ground rules, and I had to learn them really fast. So they were dealing with an inexperienced person who didn't know the ground rules. So we both had to negotiate together. And it was obviously a situation that created some misunderstandings and created great, wonderful alliances. So it was very mixed, but I felt ultimately it was really worth pursuing. And I really felt that there were the very people who actually had the most apprehension, who had the most reservations. I got emails from them saying that they had really no idea, even if when I explained to them my concept, they had really no idea what I was doing. And once they saw my exhibition, they were very moved. And it was beyond the shadow of a doubt. It was all the people who actually resisted me the most were my greatest allies once they saw what I had done. So that was that.
Thank you. Those are the questions. Thank you very much. There's one, two, three, four. No, one, two, three. Okay.
I can be relatively brief. Terry, I have to say you're unconstructed and unreconstructible. But amongst many of the unreconstructible things you said, I do want you to address, and perhaps the others could address, the issue that has to do with making a practice and making a career and making the distinction between the artist having a practice and the curator only having a career. Now, you softened that a little bit, but it seems to me that many artists also are curators. Some curators are also artists, and it's a much more fluid set of arrangements than you might suggest, quite apart from the extremes. And whether you want to respond or perhaps some of the others might respond, it seems to me that it's a sort of crucial issue, or should be at issue as a crucial issue at this conference.
I'm going to ask David to respond first to that. Because he has
first, I may have said that, but I wasn't under the impression that's what I said.
Yeah. I told you they're all diplomats. I mean, you listen to how Spring handled the Royal Ontario Museum. I used to teach there. I think that she made a miracle. David.
Well, actually, I was gonna stand up for Terry there and say that I didn't think he said that either. I think he said that. I don't really want to paraphrase him, but I think in terms of curators, he wasn't saying that curators only have a career, but that curators are important in terms of constructing an artist's career, as opposed to that.
Well, I heard what John heard.
I'm including in the notion of curatorship, I would definitely include artists, both self and on behalf of others. I mean, I mentioned the Kossuth Play of the Unmentionables in response to it. There's an artist that has been engaged, let's say, with the problems of curatorship as production. So if I said that, John, I apologize. I didn't mean to imply that. I'm not trying to back off, I don't think. You know, there are curators who are not my best friends. And there are artists, I guess.
Such a gentle soul. How can anyone not like you? We have two more questions.
Yes, John O'Brien, Joanne Lemoureux.
Could you introduce yourself and could you stand up? It's Joanne, isn't it?
Yes, Joanne Lemoureux. John took care of part of the question I had, a remark on this opposition between artists and curators, because show me my own things, include them in your work, make me part of your work. So I think that it's one of the questions that is very central to this new relationship between curators and museum, and I would have liked to hear Spring or any other member of this panel on it.
Well, it's a very broad question. I believe that the people I was working directly with, I believe that the curator, the people who really were actually directly involved with the project were an entity unto themselves, and I believe that the directors and, you know, the heads of departments were not understanding the process, or they were not involved. So there was an unfortunate separation between the the head of exhibitions, the directors, while they were briefed, they didn't really, it was not an issue for them. They only became interested or involved after the fact. Once the exhibition was actually up, you know, they came to the opening, they spoke eloquently, but they really talked to me after saying that they had no real idea what my process was, what I was going to do, and how I was going to create this work. It was only in the aftermath that they started to say, oh, there's something going on here.
Could I just intervene? There are two entities at the Royal Ontario Museum. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it was the Institute of Contemporary Culture that invited you.
Yes.
And you chose for your project to engage the whole museum.
Yes.
So there were two administrations that you were tangling with.
That's correct.
I just wanted to make that clear. Wait, there's a question over here. Sigrid, do you want to stand up, please? And introduce yourself.
I'm Sigrid Schade. I would like to say that, well, it's not really a question. I remarked by the contributions from the panelists that more or less the power and the fascination of the museum as an institution, which can be very, very powerful, was addressed sometimes even without really naming it. And especially, for example, well, you could in some sense react to that power in a way you say, well, the power I feel from this institution is so strong that one person alone is not able to fight it, which was one of the positions I understood. The other one would have been to become absolutely fascinated by being part of that power, or having become part of that power, which for me was absolutely clear in what Spring told us. And I wanted to ask you really whether this was exactly what you wanted people to get out of your exhibition, that in the end, finally, you say, we are all alike in death. I can't believe it. And also, I wanted to ask you whether you really think that without a comment, and in this sacralized kind of showing these things, well, they didn't need a comment. I can't believe this either.
Pardon? They didn't need what?
That they didn't need a comment, and I can't believe this either. And I know about this power, and I just reminded me that when I left the museum long, long time ago, after 2 years of having been a curator there, in the end, I did exactly the opposite thing. I left something in a showcase which didn't belong to it, as long as I had the access and the keys to it. And I just wondered how long it would take until somebody would realize that there was something wrong in the showcase.
What did you do?
I left something, something which didn't belong in a showcase. Oh. I left it on my last day in that museum.
Oh, right.
And trying to find out how long it would take until somebody would remark it.
Uh-huh.
Which, from now, I can see it's also some kind of artistic intervention.
Uh-huh. Well,
we're almost out of time. No, go ahead, please.
Okay.
I'm looking for Joyce. Are you here? Where are you? I can't hear you. There's one more question, I think, after that.
Okay,
Spring, go ahead.
Well, your question really is based on the fact that you don't think there are that there are a lot of distinctions in the objects and artifacts that I chose. Is that what you're asking me?
No, I think if I understand the question, it is that all of us are fascinated by the power of the museum.
Okay.
And that you gave yourself to it in a certain way.
Well, what I did was I recognized that if I wanted to actually see this project through, if I wanted to see a concept through, that I would have to negotiate very, very hard and long to accomplish that. It seemed to me not an option to give up seemed like not the kind of, maybe the option to give up would have been an option that might have been preferred, but I really felt very strongly about going through the whole process.
No red shoes.
Pardon me?
No red shoes. I mean, you didn't drop a pair of red shoes.
The idea of actually doing that exhibition was very, very difficult, actually. There was a lot of pressure on me to dilute my program of work. And even towards the very end, marketing came forward and said, we have to have disclaimers on the walls saying that why there are dead specimens in this room en masse from the scientific study collection. Ichthyology insisted on a disclaimer saying that the fish in the jars were no longer how they practiced scientific exploration. So there was an incredible amount of anxiety surrounding this exhibition, and there was a lot of energy and anxiousness about public perception. You may think of this as a very benign show. You may think of this show as somehow confirming to the power of the museum, but I can assure you that their collective anxiety was extremely strong, and getting permission through was extremely difficult, and there was an incredible amount of energy on my part as an artist and on my team to keep moving through and to keep getting permission from department to department. And where every department in the museum can withhold any specimen or artifact they so choose and have a million rationales to do so.
Spring, I think Robert wants to say something.
Sure.
Well, I want to continue on the issue of power of the museum. When I was asked by the AGO, and well, I mentioned Philip Monk, to do a, and it's all part of the new texture with museum activity or curatorial practice, for that matter, the idea of interventions. I never experienced something as has the omnipotence of a museum as in my relationship, not with Philip. He was as a curator, he was perfect to work with. He was very understanding, and he was very accommodating. But going back to the security guard notion as well, is what happened to me was in 1992, I did a collaborative work with Greg Stutz, and we wanted to go back to the Walker Court and photograph, again, the same experience I had at the Guggenheim. Because at the Guggenheim here, I saw a photographer, and you know, it's a round ramp, and I was just about to get out my little throwaway camera and photograph Ojibwe. Why not? That's who I am. And I figured there would be no problem with photographing that, and you sort of sense an ownership towards it, you know, because it's, you know, it's like photographing Canadian somewhere. It's on a wall in a gallery. But no, it changes, you know? Because at the Guggenheim, the guard, I said, well, I saw somebody taking a photograph, and I said, oh, this is the States, it's a different rule. So I grabbed my camera, and I was going to click. And just at that moment, the security guard came up to me and said, excuse me, sir, but you can't do that. And I said, why not? What about him? And he said, well, that's the artist. And he said, you can get permission from him. And, you know, I had already had a similar experience at the AGO about Greg Stats and I sent him to the AGO to photograph the Walker Court with the text on the, he came back to the studio and he was just about to kill the first person, you know, a white person. He was just so mad. And I said, wait a minute. I said, let me get on the phone. And I said, well, let me call security guard. And I said, and I did call the AGO. And they said, well, you know, if you want to photograph that, you'll have to get permission from the artist, or you can negotiate or talk to the curator, you know, oh, and all of that stuff. And I said, no, we just want to come in and photograph the architectural details of the Walker Court. And he said, oh, that's not a problem. How long will it take? And this, you know. So we came, Greg, and said, 10, 15 minutes. And wow, you know, we subverted that. And but, you know, it was a learning experience about the power of the museum and the power of curators and the power, once you bring something into a new context like that, things change, and that's what I was trying to allude to when I was.
But I think the question is really important, and to what extent is there this fascination, to what extent are we in thrall to it, all of us? If it's any comfort to you, the National Gallery wouldn't let me photograph my own work. I have one quick question. No, it's true. I'll tell you the whole story later. One quick question that I have for David, because this is a story you told me a while ago about, I think it was the Biennale, it was some international exhibition where you held the curator hostage.
Yes, that was, I think I lost all our shows for about 5 years after that one. It was, Venice Biennale in 1986. When I arrived, I discovered that the space that I was installing in was the space through which all crates had to come in and out of the Arsenale building, which was a bit of a problem. The architect said, enjoy Venice, you know, you have 13 days, no problem. When it came, and someone, not a curator, I wouldn't say, but gallery support people, the people in charge of helping me install, a fellow named Dario Del Bufalo came to me and said, Mr. Rokeby, I understand your work even better than you do. You will have everything you need. So, I very comforted, I went off and enjoyed Venice while I couldn't work on my piece. The day before the opening, he came to me and said, I'm very sorry, but you can't have any light. And in this case, this is an interactive sound installation that used cameras to analyze movement and translate it into sound, and without light, I had nothing. Piled on this, there were a number of administrative screw-ups, which I don't need to go into, but which were sufficient to create a situation where it was impossible to go ahead. And after trying to resolve my grievances with the Biennale organization, I walked back up and down the canal bridges back to the Arsenale and started to take my work down. At which point, I think it was Robert Adrian, who most of you are probably familiar with, came over and said, "Psst, David, we're all having problems. I think we have more power here than we think we do. We happen to have had a 1 billion lira account with Italian telephone because there was some telecommunications work happening. We had fax machines, photocopiers, and four large projection screens in the center of the Arsenale on the way towards the Aperto exhibit. So everyone was going to come this way. And we just let a very small rumor fly to the right ears that if we didn't have everything we needed in 2 hours, which included hotels that were kicking us out of, even though we hadn't had a chance to install our work, then we would send press releases to every country in the world and hand out handbills and project our complaints on these projection screens. Now, within an hour, we had everything we needed. So
that's what it takes. Terry has one quick story, too. Thanks, David.
Yeah,
into the mic, please. No, we're recording you.
Yeah, there's one recently. There was an exhibition in London called Living in Your Head, which was one of these blockbuster refurbishing of conceptualism shows. And it's a big show, art from the 60s and 70s, conceptual, supposedly anyway. And including that was one of the art and language indexes. Now, my wife Sue was teaching at the University of Wolverhampton at the time. I took a party of students down there and wanted them to try and figure out the index, which would have been interesting since I've never really figured it out. And she got there and it was locked. So what it is a series of big boxes with drawers in which there are a lot of text. That's basically what it is. And she went to the desk and said, "We want to read the text." And they said, "Well, the artists have said that the thing must be locked." And she said, "I don't think so. My husband was one of them." And so they shifted tack and was sent upstairs. I mean, it turned out to be an insurance firm. So when we talk about the power of the museums, I mean, we're not just talking about one particular geographical space. We're talking about a whole chain of the relations of distribution. I mean, somebody bought this, I don't know who it was, in the early 70s for probably quite a lot of money. And texts get damaged. But there's nothing we could do about it. I mean, it's out of my hands, et cetera, et cetera. I wish I'd have had David's gumption, or even the opportunity to hold the Whitechapel curatorial staff, or otherwise, hostage.
On that note, I want to thank David, Spring, Robert, and Terry.
Thanks very much.